This week's episode of One Shot is brought to you by Emporium. Emporium's three Chicagoland locations combine the best arcade games, craft beer, and live events. Check out emporiumchicago.com/CPC for a free drink or game tokens. We are Hello, heroes, and welcome to another exciting episode of One Shot. I'm James D'Amato, your Game Master. This week, we'll be playing a unique and fascinating game designed by Flavio Mortarino and Renato Ramonda, called A Scoundrel in the Deep. Scoundrel eschews the more traditional dice and card-based mechanics for a book of matches. To avoid the hazards of an impossibly deep and dangerous cave, players must describe how they avoid them while holding a lit match. If they can finish their description before the flame touches their fingers, they succeed. And if not, the deep grows ever closer to claiming another victim. Of course, Scoundrel's not just unique because of its resolution mechanic. Scoundrel in the Deep is also a two-player game, one GM and one player. And to help me play, I brought on Jeff Stormer from the Party of One podcast. Before we get to the game, I want to remind our Los Angeles area heroes that I will be at the Game House Cafe on November 26th at 4 p.m. for a meet and greet with most of our Left Coast fans. I'll also be joined by special guests Jeff and John from the System Mastery podcast. If you're in LA or around the area, I would love to meet you while I'm in Los Angeles visiting some friends and family and recording a few things. If you want to do that, this is your best opportunity. Once again, I will be at the Game House Cafe, that's House H-A-U-S Cafe, November 26th at 4 p.m. I've already reserved us spaces and prepaid for them, so I would love to see people show up. Now I'd like to take a moment and thank our backers on Patreon.
All right, Beth, we're going to go out on a limb here and say thank you, Beth Zieglovix.
Thank you so much, Beth.
But Beth has... I don't know if she's done art for us before, actually. She's an artist. Matt Lee, thank you. That's nice, wizard.
Yeah. Hi, Matt. Thomas Swingler, thank you.
Ian Fassel, thank you.
Josh Mackin, thank you.
Cody, thank you.
Thanks, Cody. Matthew Koberlin, thank you.
David Silverstein, thank you.
Rob Smith, thank you.
Livy and Ashley Watkinson, thank you.
Oh, Livy and Ashley, thank you guys so much. They're good.
They are good.
They're very good. They manage the never... Well, Livy manages the Never Tell Me the Pod's Facebook.
What? That's not pranks?
I think he does portions of it, but she does all the little write-ups and stuff.
Man, I need somebody to do that for me.
You're the worst.
Well, I mean... The Never the Tell Me the Pod's Facebook is objectively better than the One Shot Facebook. Not a single person listening to this right now will disagree.
Right, because Livy's the best.
Thanks once again to all of our backers on Patreon. You make what we do possible. If you like what we do here on One Shot, please consider becoming a Patreon backer and donating a small amount each month to the show. If everyone listening donated $2 a month, I could quit my day job tomorrow and focus on bringing you guys new campaigns with fantastic new performers. We'd also be able to pay the fantastic performers who lend themselves to each episode, and I would love to do that. Thanks to everyone who contributes and listens to One Shot for your support. You're literally making our dreams come true. And with all that out of the way, let's get to the show.
All right, heroes, let's meet our party for this week. And that is going to be a very, very small party. And I'm actually going to be in it because I'm playing. So I guess I should be saying, let's meet our guest GM for the week, Jeff Stormer.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, James.
Jeff, I'm so happy to have you here. The reason that we're having you on is this is a two-player game.
Yes.
And you host a podcast called Party of One.
I do. It is an actual play about two-player role-playing games. So every week I sit down with a guest one-on-one, and we play either a game that is designed for two, like 183 Days, or Our Radios Are Dying, or I play a game that is sort of like hacked into being two-player games, like your favorite role-playing game.
Oh, Feng Shui?
Yes. Actually, I played Feng Shui on the show several times, and it's great.
Yeah, I guess I could see that because it's an action movie thing.
Well, and
there's
some specific rules mechanics in it that say, like, if you're one person fighting eight people, here's the rules for you.
There we go. Oh, cool. I think it's a great thing because one of the limitations of RPGs, or the limitations that people impose on it, is that you need to have a group of people available.
Yes.
And there are so many people who's like, you know, good games start at having four people.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, every week on campaign, we're playing with three, which is a relatively small party. And the recent Binbon and Jubna episodes, we went down to two. But one-on-one roleplay is not only possible, but very rewarding.
It's very good. I'm a very big fan of it. And I'm really excited to get to share that with people and share, like, it's a really emotional experience. And I get to, like, experience that every week. And it's cool.
Yeah. That's actually one of the cool things about one-on-one roleplay is that there's only one person. So I think it makes it a little bit easier to be vulnerable when you're role playing.
And it's like very intimate because it's just two people in a space, and that's an intimate experience on its own. So it lends itself very well to high emotion, and it's exciting. I'm very excited.
So with that, we are going to be playing this week A Scoundrel in the Deep.
Yes, I'm so excited.
This first showed up in Worlds Without Master?
Yes.
Worlds Without Master is a role-playing magazine type thing put out by Epidiah Ravichal.
Yes, that is correct. And it's got like comics and tables and occasionally a micro game that they put in. And this is a complete micro game. It's about six pages and it's very cool. It is played with two people and a book of matches.
Yeah, that's right. Matches are the mechanic for this game. So, you know, people who are pyromaniacs and fans of RPGs, you know, this falls in the 10 candles category of must
play. This is for you.
Yeah. Before we get started, I do want to point out Epidiah Ravichal is the creator of Dread.
Yes.
So if you respect that piece of work, definitely check out Worlds Without Master.
Yes, and it's got stuff from – I know Nathan Paletta, who's on Worldwide Wrestling, has put in stuff for it. And it's got it's a lot of cool people are submitting a lot of cool things.
Yeah, it's one of those things. You subscribe through Patreon.
Yes.
And I am very upset that we were not able to get a sponsorship spot in time for that because, man, I would love to be advertising that magazine. But – with that said, I think it's time to begin. And Jeff, you have volunteered.
Yes.
To play the Deep.
I am playing the Deep. You are going to be playing the Scoundrel. You are deep in a tomb. You have completed your quest. You have the Ruby of the Deep, and your only goal now is to escape. So let me ask you, who is the Scoundrel? The Scoundrel is an adventurer who has plunged to the bottom of this tomb. So, are you more of a Conan? Are you a Grey Mouser?
I would definitely say closer to Grey Mouser than Conan. But, you know, not as cocky and confident as the Grey Mouser.
Okay.
I wandered into the Deep because I am a desperate man.
Okay.
The rubies of the Deep are sort of fabled across the land for their properties.
Yeah.
It's said that the first ruby before they went into the Deep, this collection was mined from one of the tunnels that the gods themselves placed on this earth as their signature. And the first ruby that entered this world passed the lips of a king and made him immortal. It's said that he roams this earth to this day, no longer seeking dominion over man. My scoundrel needs these rubies because there is someone that he loves who is very sick.
Understandable.
And he would do anything to get them.
And so you find yourself at the bottom of the tomb, and I'm going to ask you to read the opening words and then select two items that you have brought with you.
Hours have passed since I conquered the ruby at the bottom of the tomb of the Deep. Luckily, I still have. And right now, I will point out to people that I am looking at a list of equipment. Perhaps I will make something up on my own, but the listed tools of the trade are a length of silk rope, an old but sharp dagger, four sturdy iron spikes, the scroll of Anuba, a vial of extremely corrosive fire beetle acid, the blessing of the Dawn Priestess, a perfectly balanced throwing knife, Yan, a mercenary of the Isthmus of War, Shirat, Abbas of the Sun Goddess, or make up something on our own.
But no lights.
No lights in the dark.
And the one thing I will point out is several items on that list are living beings, and you may find some sapient items along the way.
Mm.
You may think that this is a good thing. This is a tragic happening.
Yes.
Because at the end, if you make it out, you make it out alone.
Yes.
Know that as you make your choices. They may be helpful to you, but know that if you make it out, you make it out alone.
My character has a short sword, sturdy, strong, and useful, and a locket that contains a piece of his lover's hair.
That's good. That's very, very good. So the next thing is I will describe to you the first room that we find ourselves in. This is an old, old mine that was mined by the dwarves that lived here many years ago. Those dwarves are long gone. You haven't heard of a dwarf in ages. Even though it is functional in design, there are intricate runes on the walls, and they've put up these statues almost as a reminder of studiousness and work and like working hard. The ruby in your satchel, and you see that there is only one way ahead of you, which is the way that you came in. The only way out is through one of these long industrialized mining tunnels, lined with the runes that glow for a moment and then leave you in just pitch black darkness. The stones underneath your feet are sharp. Everything smells like rusted metal, and every step you take seems to echo out and out and out. So now I'm going to ask you to read the next thing and, I believe, hand me a match.
My lamp dwindles. Tired and hungry, I scramble in the pitch dark. Only a few matches in my pocket separate me from endless, inky blackness. My fate is in my own hands.
But peril lurks in the dark. You hear your footsteps echoing, echoing, echoing. One step, then two steps. That's not an echo. There is another set of footsteps nearby. It could be nothing, but it is coming from ahead of you. You're on a collision course. Now I'll give you an inlet match. And as you are currently holding the matchbook, you light the match. You see one of the statues has come to life, and it is coming towards you, marching quietly.
I carefully pull back from the statue, feeling along the wall. There are rock crevices that are open and wide. I climb above the statue as it brings a mottled hand into the wall, sending stones flying about. One of those stones dislodges and comes down upon the statue's arm, shattering it, crumbling it to pieces.
And now you may blow out the candle. Candle, match, what, the thing with the fire.
Hey, it's one of those games, right?
Yep. So you were successful. The way it works is the scoundrel, you've lit the match, you've described how you've conquered the threat, and you blew it out, which means that you get to keep the spent match. If you collect enough of them, you'll make it out alive.
Okay. And just so listeners at home know, Jeff got to describe the threat after the match was lit.
Yes.
And then I had to describe how I conquered it before the match fire reached my fingers.
Yes, it is terrifying. As a man that does not enjoy fire, it is a terrifying experience. As you receive the spent match, you can keep the matchbox. Now you describe how you've defeated the threat. You've taken its arm off. It's still coming towards you, but you describe to me how you conquer it once and for all.
The rumble on the wall dislodges the scoundrel. He falls. Knowing that there are sharp stones beneath his feet, he winces in the air. And he comes down, luckily, upon a bed of thick black moss. The statue again looms towards him, reaching out with its other side. It has become unbalanced. The scoundrel can see the statue, its twisted, horrid face in the darkness, reflecting off of the faint light from the dying runes. The scoundrel moves to the side, covered in soot and blackness, the moss leaking upon his flesh. He dodges out of the way again, the statue, unsteady but cruelly looming forward, smashes another finger, another piece of its arm, on this side of the wall. More rocks dislodge. The scoundrel's breathing heavily now, his ragged breaths coming in and out, pushing him forward, still hearing the stirring rumble of the walking statue behind him. The scoundrel moves down the hallway, still stepping carefully as not to trip, hearing the lumbering stone behind him. It slashes again with a foot, with an arm, every piece of its hateful being striking out and bashing itself to pieces on the floor. The scoundrel is left, knowing that he can move only forward, and knowing that the very walls of the cave itself, these horrible stone beings, wish for his death.
Now, as you conquered the threat, you were able to describe an item that you found that is useful to you, related to the threat. And then you may describe the next location that you get to in a few details, where you find yourself next. So what is the item that you find as you survey this shattered statue and as you move forward through the tunnels?
So the scoundrel, dusting himself off, checking for any serious injury that could become a problem later, notices some of the moss that he fell into clings to his clothing. He takes it off to throw it away, but is overwhelmed by a deep and musty aroma. This is blackroot moss, moss that is known for many things. To an uncareful alchemist, it can be an early death. To a shrewd studier of alchemical arts, it can be something that can kill pain. Perhaps not needed now, but maybe soon, the scoundrel thinks, as he places the moss into one of the pouches on his waist.
Now, the thing about items that is important is at any time, you may immediately destroy a threat by destroying an item.
That's really cool.
Yeah, if you and the way it would normally work, if we were not in a convention recording room, the way it would normally work is you have all of your items written out on cards. You would then take the match and burn that card and throw it into the ashtray.
Yeah, probably not what we're going to be doing in the recording area that we are in now. But someday I will record this on the One Shot Twitch stream so that we can get a little bit more of a tactile experience from it. But so, that's really cool.
Yeah. So you're literally burning the things that you have in order to survive. So now describe to me where you find yourself next. What's the next space you walk into?
The space that the scoundrel was dreading more than anything. The still, musty air of the tight tunnels that led to the ruby's chamber begins to open up. His steps echo and then soon become lost as the world opens up around him. He curses at the few remaining matches. How could he have been foolish enough to lose his torch? How could he have not brought more oil for his lantern? As the room opens up into the cavernous, thin, and precarious stone bridge.
You hear silence. Even your echoes, which have been your only source of comfort, have vanished. As you're walking across this large stone bridge, you start to hear the trickling of water beneath you. You know that this is like an underground river where the dwarves were drawing water from to fuel the miners. But a new peril lurks in the dark. You hear a splashing. It's not a natural splashing. Like, it's not merely water hitting rock. You hear, like, gentle water flowing for a while, and then you hear splashing. And then you hear a great deal of splashing. It comes from the east and localizes right underneath where you're standing on the bridge.
Great. Another match.
Tentacles rise up from beneath your feet. There's about three of them. They surround you. They have not grabbed you yet.
I think back to my childhood, my brother who was fallen by a beast of the water, its nasty green scales rising from the deep, and I think of how he taught me to avoid it. Salt, salt on my skin. The sweat on my brow is the very thing that dries out these tentacles and defeats the beast.
Perfect.
Oh, man, I almost dropped that one.
So I've got some water here in case we drop it.
Yeah.
I've just been drinking it, but in fact, that's probably going to be helpful in case we drop a lit match on a table. So once again, you were successful. Describe how you ultimately overcome the threat. Describe an item that you find and take me to the next location.
Moving quickly, feeling the tentacles slither across the floor, knowing that even one false move could send him tumbling beneath, not only to deal with a monster on its own terms, but deal with it as a broken, ruined man. The scoundrel pulls his sword from his side and quickly wipes his hand across his brow, thinking back once again to the words that his brother told him. It dries them, makes them wither up. You need only speak the words. Salt is from the gods. Salt is the thing that banishes the water. Salt is the thing that banishes what banishes man itself. The gods poured salt in the oceans to drown the demons that lurk below, and salt is how we fight back. He says the words that he committed to memory so long ago that his brother taught him before passing away. He chants under his breath, drying the sweat onto the sword. Tiny salt crystals harden onto it. Then the tentacle lashes out in front of him in the dark. He can't see it, but he can feel it move and the disturbances in the air. It's why he had to wear something so little. His tiny tunic allows the air to move through to his skin, feeling the wind and disturbance in the air. He lashes forward with the sword. The beast doesn't scream. The beast merely retreats, searching back below for easier prey.
So, what item do you find that's going to help you in this?
As he moves forward, coming across the bridge, he pats his foot across the ground again, knowing it's very unstable here. And his foot hits something soft. He bends down and grabs the rope that he had left for himself, the rope that he needed to climb down here in the first place. He secures it around his arms and begins his climb upwards.
So you find yourself on the other side of this bridge. What is waiting for you?
Oh my god.
I mean, what room is waiting for you? What room is on the other side of this? Tracks continue along you through the mines. What's the next stop on our magical mystery tour?
The scoundrel ascends the rope, and he approaches yet another passage that he did not wish to encounter. The climb down to the bridge was not the only part of the climb. As he reaches the top of the rope, he comes to a tight, thin crevice. One where he can barely breathe, for the expansion of his chest makes it hard for him to pass through. He left spikes along the walls so that he could climb down, but now he must ascend back up. It's easy for some spelunkers to reach a position where they can no longer move forward. He prays that his trail is good enough that he will be able to do so.
But peril lurks in the dark. You are climbing through this crevice. You're making your way, and it is as tight and unyielding as you remember. And you smell the dust around you of an ancient mine that no one has been in you can't say how long. Certainly no one you've ever spoke to has said they've ever gone into the mine. This was the domain of the dwarves, and they are gone. You smell that dust, and it seems to be getting thicker around you, more odious, more musty. It seems like it would be the opposite, that as you get further, closer to the entrance, the dust would dissipate, but it's quite the opposite. And in fact, you stop. You stand there first. You stay on your perch for a moment. No, it is growing around you. The dust is moving, and it is surrounding you. So I'm going to ask you to light the match. So the way, the way it will work is you will immediately blow that out if you want to use an item.
Okay. Cool. I'm going to risk it once more.
Okay. As you are looking at this dust, you see faces. Faces of dwarves long past in the dust surrounding you. They have come to you in the form of their own grave dust to take you.
The widow's soot, he mutters under his breath. This is the thing that has claimed the life of many miner, dwarf and man. Think of light. He pictures the light in his head as the faces of the dwarves reach out to him, trying to bite at his flesh. He sees the sun. He sees her face. And he defeats it. Oh, Jesus. Close. That was so close. Well, you now control the matchbook, right?
Yes.
That was three times in
yes.
a row.
Fate is fickle and the wheel turns. You let your fate slip through your fingers. Describe to me how you overcome this, and then an item that comes from that.
The scoundrel is sitting there trying to picture the sun as the dwarves call him to the grave in their thick tongue. Most men not set in the deep in a dark room thinking of their own demise. The words of a dwarf echo in your chest, rumble inside you, and remind you of the power in their limbs. These dwarves shout curses, shout dark things that pull him into an inky blackness, and the only light, the only thing that pulls him towards life is his own thought, his own will. The scoundrel struggles and coughs and spits. If there were light, he would see the blood that the living dust, the sentient widow's soot, has torn from his insides. But as it comes closer and closer, filling his lungs, making his breaths more shallow, even as he climbs out, pulling against the spikes that he left for himself, fading slowly, thinking of fainting, he clings to that sun. And as the soot touches the sun in his mind, it shrieks and recoils. As soon as the widow's soot was set upon him, it recedes. The scoundrel coughs, sputters. His breath is much less sure now. He can feel the bleeding inside of him, but he is alive.
What item waits for you at the top of this crevice, where the lower level mining opens up to sort of a more of an industrial sort of trading post area? What item waits for you?
The scoundrel pulls himself up. Again, his breathing is incredibly ragged. One of his lungs is immensely damaged. He tries to remain calm, but panic begins to set in. He knows that he was told by the man who gave him the map that would guide him to the entrance of the tomb of the ruby, that he must not deviate from the trail, that the dwarven trading post went on longer than a man could walk. One could start when he was a boy and end gray and wrinkled without reaching the other side. The man smiled with fire glinting off of his rotting teeth. I must find something. I must find something. He begins to search around him, feeling around with his fingers in the darkness for anything that could give him the strength to move forward, and his hand falls upon something, a small clay pot, sealed with wax. He takes the sword from his side, shakily applying it to the wax, moving it around to break the seal, and as he does, the air is full of sweet-smelling flowers, Alwyn's perfume. Alwyn's perfume is made of crushed roots and branches from a tree that grows higher than any other, a tree that is closest to the gods. Their tears kiss it every night when it rains. These leaves are the holiest leaves in all of existence. Dwarven traders prized them because they could clear one's lung of impurities. He drinks deep with his nose, pulling in the scent, the sweet scent of this blessing. He can feel his lungs open up. He knows that he'll need treatment once he gets out of the cave, but this will keep him alive just a bit longer.
Excellent. So as I have the matchbook, I will describe the next place you find yourself, and It is you are marching deeper into this marketplace, this dwarven trading post. It goes on. You walk for, could be minutes, could be hours. There's no light. And you're not sure. You just see, like, the faint outlines of buildings. And you come upon almost a dumbwaiter, one of those big industrial transport things that goes from floor to floor. The chains are rusted, but a few of them still stand. But the actual platform the chains have long since rusted off. You stand there and you study the area, and there are crates of supplies that have long since all rotted through. Whole bunch of rotted wood and shattered stone. You see boots and hard hats and helmets with no bodies. The bodies have long since rotted, like dissolved. The remnants of people, almost like shadows of people that once were trapped in this place. And there is peril in the dark. So the way it works is exactly the same way. It just, instead of you lighting it and passing it to me and me passing it back, I'm just already going to have it to describe the peril.
So when I had the matchbook, I was at a disadvantage.
Yes.
Great.
Now you see how the dark works. So
every time I succeed, it gets hard. That's great.
Yeah, it's fabulous. The objects start to chitter and dance and come for you. The stones and tools themselves seem to have come alive with restless spirits too.
The scoundrel moves quickly as a tidal wave of objects follow behind him. He heads towards the door, the giant brass construction of the dwarves. The one that was so hard to pry open earlier. He runs for it. That narrow... Oh! What happens if it goes out?
That is a failure.
Oh, no!
Yep. Go ahead and toss that in there.
The match just went out in my hand as I was holding it.
If it burns out or burns you, that is considered a failure for either of us. So if it burns out while I'm describing, then you have succeeded without effort.
Oh, man!
So I keep the matchbook. So you get hurt. You try to pull this door. Your fingernails crack and bleed, and you pull it, and the objects start to, like, dance around. They start to just approach you, and they're coming, and they're coming. But you can't get the door open. You see that it's just rusted too shut, and it's been closed too long, and that some doors will never open again. You pull on it. You will have to find a different way to go. You turn and you run blindly into the dark through this trading post, ducking around alleyways as the trading post itself seems to want to drag you into the abyss. You keep ducking and weaving, and you find yourself in a spot that you were not before. You no longer know the safest way. You only know that you have to keep going up and back and up and back.
The traitor's words once again echo in his mind. You could die wrinkled and gray, walking before you saw the end.
You find yourself at the entranceway to another set of tunnels. You suspect if there are tunnels, there must be the mouth to them, because there must be a place where they are sending the carts with the supplies to get out. It is only about wide enough for one of these carts, so maybe 10 feet long, 10 feet high. It is very neatly carved out. That in itself is almost unnerving, because you're in this cave and it is a perfect square. Everything is equal. The runes on the walls have been carved deep, but you see scratches along them as the madness that trapped these dwarves in there forced them to try to claw their way out. Peril lurks in the dark. This game is dope.
It's really cool.
Take this match and light it.
Oh, one. Two.
All right. So you walk for a little while.
And did we point that out on air?
No. So what happens if you do two pulls and the match does not light? What happens is, if it happens with the dark, what happens is it turns out to be nothing. You see the scratches along the walls. You steal your sword. You reach for the hilt. And you see mice. You see common cave rats scratching at the walls as they grab bugs and shove them into their mouths. Common cave rats.
The scratches still echo in his mind, each one making him jump. Each one making him think it could be something darker lurking out there. It's so thick, so black, that his hearing has grown to be impeccable. And so even safe sounds of mice eating insects as they let out their death rattle screams dances across his mind, a torture of the dark.
So feel free to describe an item in the next room, if you so choose.
The scoundrel reaches the end of the tunnel, where he sees several carts piled up against a wall. He smacks it with his hand, and it echoes with the hum of solid brass. He falls to his feet, knowing that this yet another dwarf door of solid construction bars his path. He begins to weep, and as he wipes tears from his face, his hand crosses something cold lying on the ground. He picks it up. It's a strange object with intricate geometry on it. His hands dance across it. He can feel the dwarvish runes beneath his fingers as they move across this object. And suddenly his mind lights up with knowledge of what it is. A key. He moves over to the side of the door, shakily trying to fit the key into a latch. A few failed attempts begin to fill him with depression once more, but suddenly, a click, as the intricate gears, even hundreds of years after not being used, fit into place, and slowly the door opens itself. Once the door is open, the scoundrel removes the key and places it upon his belt. On the other side of the door is a piece of ground that has wood at the bottom. Immediately, the scoundrel becomes nervous. He doesn't place all of his weight on his foot as he taps it around the room to make sure the floor beneath him is stable. It doesn't feel as though it's going to give way, but it doesn't feel steady either. The scoundrel steps upon the floor. The room shakes around him. He feels brass netting on the walls. He moves around the room and finds himself in a box. It's about 8 by 8, and there is an intricate panel on the door with another spot for a key. This is a lift. He does not know where it will go.
So, that brass netting, it is... You actually briefly prick your finger on it because so much, like, the rust has chewed through a lot of it. There's open spaces, and you look at this panel, and it has been ripped out, and the dwarven engineering and wiring is scattered about. Like, it might work, it might not work. There's no saying for sure until you try it. But the panel itself is just two large buttons, one milky white and one sort of a rich crimson. You can guess based on your own assumptions which one is which, but there's no telling for sure. And there is peril in the dark.
Okay. Well, after having learned the very important lesson of matches being real difficult to light...
Things start to crawl through the holes in the netting. Spiders, but the largest spiders that you've ever seen, the size of a fist with big, gaping fangs dripping with blood. But you can't tell how old that blood is because there's nothing other than the rats. There's nothing living in these tunnels.
So the scoundrel grabs for the key on his side and forces it into the mechanism for the elevator. It shutters up. Many of the spiders... Ah, fuck. Oh, so close, yet so far.
So you reach for the key and you fumble for it. You try to reattach the panel and try to twist the key in, but the panel is too damaged. You can't get it to work. You try to swat away the spiders to give you more time. You maybe knock one of them away, but more of them keep coming in. The floor has begun to just appear black and furry and crawling, and you eventually realize you're not going to have an escape. You're not going to be able to operate the elevator. Your only option is, I'm going to give you a choice. Do you climb up or do you jump down?
Climb up.
Okay, you climb, and the spiders are climbing after you. They're on your ankles. You're shaking them off. You can't use your feet to climb. You are just pulling. Your palms are bleeding. You just pull with everything you have. You find yourself on an alcove. There is blackness in front of you. This is some sort of natural tunnel. This is not the dwarves. You planned on the dwarves, and now you are in the open wild of these caverns.
The dwarves fell to the madness of the blackness below. Earth harbors demons. Beneath its oceans, embedded in its rock, the dwarves must have been cursed by the gods, thought the scoundrel, to have to live within the belly of the earth, to be subject to the predations of these unnatural horrors every day, to feel them curling beneath their feet every time they walked about the marketplace. It was only a matter of time before they fell. And now I face once again the untamed blackness. He swings off the elevator's rope, catches himself on the side of the tunnel. He feels the numbness in his feet from where the spiders bit him. He can still move, though, and marches forward.
But peril lurks in the dark. You march forward and you hear nothing. You feel nothing. You feel only the rocks under your feet, and you march and you march. But in the shadows, your eyes are playing tricks on you. You swear you see the rocks move. You swear you see them dance about, but you know that this is only the shadows from your match. This is only that little light that you have playing tricks on you. Or is it? These movements don't match with the fire. You stop and you watch it for a while, but the movements aren't matching. The shadows that are being cast do not match with the movements that you're seeing in the rocks. Now we've got match lighting moves down.
Yeah, here we go. Oh, do we though? Yes!
I'm so bad at lighting matches! I hate this.
That's what we get for being a generation that does not smoke at all.
This is true. If this were played with vapes, I'd be on top of the world right now. All right.
Man. Okay. Epidia, I hope you're out there listening, because I want a version of this that's just for dank vapes.
I realize, actually, this isn't written by Epidia.
Is it not? Oh.
No, it's written by Renato Ramonda and Flavio Mortarino.
Yeah. Renato and Flavio, if you're out there listening, we need a version of Scoundrel in the Dark that is just about dank curls from your vape clouds.
Yeah. That's really the 21st century Scoundrel in the Dark.
Yeah. It'll still be just as cool.
I dare say cooler. Okay. So you watch it for a while and no. No, this is just your heart. This is the heartbeat in your chest is causing your eyes to move in a way that is tricking you, that you're not thinking straight. They're just rocks. This is just a cavern. You just need to get outside. You've been under the earth for too long. The air down here is rotten, and it is getting into your head. You just need to keep walking. So now you take the matchbook and describe where you find yourself next.
Okay. Knowing that the air here is foul, that it not only corrupts his lungs, makes his breath shallow, but it plays tricks on his mind as well, the Scoundrel begins to doubt much around him, knowing that this doubt could save him, or it could be the thing that causes his death, which is why at first, when he sees the end of the tunnel, he doesn't believe it. He rounds a corner and he's confronted with the truth. Yes, that was light that he saw, but not light of the sun. Light of bioluminescence growing on the side of the tunnel. He enters a small room, a room where, for the first time in what he estimates to be more than one day, he sees the world around him clearly, but of course it is a violent, awful green, a demon's green, the sort of green that emanates from a demon's blood as it falls upon sacred ground that fills the air with a horrible, sharp stink, the stink of hell. He is seeing this green all around him, and he must find a way forward from the tunnel that he came from.
Peril lurks in the dark, and the thing that I will describe is that it goes dark. Suddenly. Violently.
Oh, God! No!
You are bathed in this bioluminescent light, and it is just pitch black.
Oh, that I was established was related to demons. Oh, there's one.
That's one. Oh, that was...
That was very, very close.
Ripped the paper off of this one. Okay. So, yeah, it has gone dark. It is an unnatural dark. It is a magical dark. A creature of darkness is in this room, lying in wait. It drew you in with a trap of light and waited for you and then extinguished that light to devour you.
Oh, how do you conquer it? Cool. Grabbing from his belt, the Scoundrel once again grabs his sword and drags it along the wall, lighting some small sparks to light the darkness. He sees the demon and lunges. I don't know if that's me describing that. I don't think that counts. Damn it.
You lunge and you dive and you fall you saw the ground before you. You know, bathed in that green light, that there was rocks right in front of you, and you dive, but you fall. You enter into free fall. That doesn't make any sense. You're only 2-3 feet above the ground. You should have hit the ground by now, but you're in free fall.
Ugh.
You are falling. And soon you realize that you're not actually falling. You are merely in the air. Something has drawn you into a space of pure emptiness. You are now lingering there. You scramble and you scream, and it grabs you and it pulls you. You push it off, but it rips that tiny tunic, and now it is merely shreds, and that tiny piece of protection you had from the cold is nothing. And that is the only thing that allows you to free yourself from its grasp, swim through the inky black emptiness, and find yourself back on the floor. The luminescent light, the trap that it was, is now merely more rocks. You run. You see this inky black mass in front of you, and you know to avoid it, and you run. You run until your feet, until blood is soaked into your boots, and you run, and you settle in. You run, and you stop at the last second. For now, you see that you are at the edge of a cliff. There is a catwalk along the edge of the cliff, merely maybe 4 feet. you have to cling to the edge of the cliff wall because there's a cavern, a canyon below you. Not going to have a cavern and not have the walk along the wall.
Yeah, of course.
But peril lurks in the dark.
Oh, man.
This time I'm going to light this damn match. Did it once. It's on mic that I did it one time.
Mm-hmm.
Let me think about what is waiting for you along this. There we go. A bat. You move. You pat the wall just a little too hard, and suddenly there's a huge skittering of bats all around you. You are surrounded. They are swarming you. They are making it hard to maintain your footing. They have surrounded you. And they want you to fall.
There is more dwarven construction on the walls. He pulls at the brass. It lets out a shriek that confuses the beasts and sends them scattering elsewhere.
Perfect. Describe what you find. Describe where you end up and how you conquer it.
The scoundrel felt as he was inching along the platform as the bats began to ravage his flesh with their teeth and sharp claws. He felt above him more dwarven construction, brass pipes. He pulls at them, yanking at the wall as the creatures tear at his flesh, and suddenly it tears free. And shooting out of the pipes is a strong, thick steam. That steam whistles as when the scoundrel dislodged the pipe, he did it in such a way to create a howling that confused and scattered the bats. They moved away. They moved away to haunt elsewhere in the tunnels, their ears being too sensitive to hear the shrieking of the pipes. It makes the scoundrel dizzy, but he now has something to cling to. More order in these tunnels full of chaos. He follows the dwarves once again, moving along the pipes. And as he does so, he finds another fallen dwarf on the ground. He feels the skeleton with its feet. Dwarves live a long time, and when they die, they leave a corpse that lasts a long time. Their thick bones, made of stronger earth than those of human bones. The gift of the demons, human warriors would call it as they fought dwarves on the battlefield. A human's blows cannot break a dwarf's bones. These bones clung to the equipment that the fallen dwarf miner had on his body. The scoundrel bends down and picks up the thick hide coat the dwarf was wearing and takes it, putting it on over his cold flesh. Perhaps a bit longer, thinks the scoundrel. Perhaps only a bit longer, and I shall be free.
So where do you find yourself next?
So moving along the pipes above the inky, infinite blackness of the cavern, the scoundrel finds himself at a pipe network. There are hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of interlocking pipes that made up the pneumatic system of transportation and plumbing and other civilized feature of the advanced dwarven civilization that fell prey to the demon's madness in the dark. There's many, many interlocking tubes that have been rotting for thousands, perhaps, maybe only hundreds of years. They are the only way forward. Unsteady footing, knowing that any of these pipes could burn with magma's kiss or break beneath his fingers and feet, sending him down into the blackness, the scoundrel climbs.
But peril lurks in the dark. You hear a rattling in one of the pipes. You see it start to glow with a fiery red, a light that you've seen, and then go black again as something has burned through it. You see a shape moving ahead of you. You smell soot and heat. And you feel it on your face, but you see no light. Only the light of your matches. A hand, an arm, a stretchy black arm of inky black lava-like substance of like acid-like goo has begun to reach for your head and is trying to just grab you and pull you and burn away your flesh to consume your bones.
The scoundrel shatters the perfume, filling the air with the sacred scent of the gods. The demon shrieks at the kiss of sunlight that lies beneath the scent. It fills the air, driving this horrible predator back into the darkness, screaming and injured. And in turn, the air rewards our scoundrel. Rewards our scoundrel with a kiss and memory of light. Once again, wounds in his lungs close up. His breath is stronger. He is tired. He is weak. He is beaten and ravaged, but he is still strong enough to move on.
So where do you find yourself, and what do you find? Wait, I don't think you find anything if you use an item. Yes, no, you do not get that. So where do you find yourself next? What is the next thing? Where's the next place you wander?
So the scoundrel ascends the tubes, occasionally finding something that is not secure, occasionally finding something that is strong. He climbs for what feels like hours. There is even a small area where he stops, propping himself up against many tubes to rest and grab some blessed sleep. When his eyes open, he once again moves forward, finding a massive brass pipe, one that is open to the air. There are grates on it, but they have been ravaged by time too. It is a couple minutes of work for him to move off the grate and send it clattering beneath to the inky hell below as he climbs inside the large pipe tunnel. His boots splash against the water as he enters the pipe, now just a mere trickle beneath his feet. This is the most stable and secure ground that he has been on in several days.
But peril lurks in the dark. I'm getting a real kick out of saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Loving that. You hear your breathing echoing through the pipe in and out, and you feel your heartbeat in and out. And then you hear two sets of breathing, each identical, each yours. You hear your own breathing twice, once from where you are and once from ahead of you.
God.
You see yourself younger, perhaps when you first entered the tomb. Something has taken your form and is coming towards you and seeks to take your place, seeks to take the ruby from you, and seeks to exit the tomb to live your life in your place.
I lash out with the battle of a desperate man. I reach for myself. I angrily reach my fingers around my own throat and hear my own death rattle as I choke the life from the being that has taken my face.
Describe what happens to it. What form does it take?
The fight is without weapons, brutal and long. There are times where both opponents appear as though they will be the victor. The wrestling is hard. We are slammed against the brass pipe. Due to the altered state of consciousness from the many different horrible things that I ingested and breathed in my journey through the dark, I lose myself and begin to think, which is the real me? If I fall here and this healthier man leaves the cave, won't that save my love? But sanity is a light in the dark. It is order in chaos. It is a bright spark that has yet not been extinguished. It fills me with a violent rage. I reach for the throat of that foul thing, that odious creature that has taken my face, taken my hope, and would seek to take my love. My grip tightens. It struggles to breathe. Many think that is the choking of air that kills a man when he is choked. But that is not true. It is preventing blood from getting to the brain. If a man were to die of suffocation, it would take brutal minutes. Without blood, it is a death of mere seconds. However, this is not a man. Our scoundrel knows well how to choke a man, but the creature fights back as it's choked. He must stay there, staring at his own face in the faint light of the match that is on the side of the brass pipe and watch the life leave his eyes before the being fades into a horrible, gnarled piece of flesh that contorted to mock his face. And he finds, on that creature's side, a map. The map that he had lost earlier. The map that he entered the tunnels with, that had disappeared from his side in the darkness. The map that can guide him out.
So, quick programming thing. I've got two or three more.
Okay.
Because it's going to get you to 10 or me to 5. So, either way, 2 or 3.
Oh, man. I'm going to start using more items.
Technically, you've got enough items to get you
yeah,
out.
Yeah, I'll just get out of here with items.
I shouldn't have told you that. All your items burn up.
Oh, no.
Got you. So where do you find yourself next? Where does the map take you to? It is not a complete map.
Mm-hmm. It is not a complete map. This is a dwarven blueprint. And one of the drawbacks of it being a dwarven blueprint is it is written in their now dead language. There's no way he can organize the information on it. But he does know a thing or two about how dwarven messages work. They're runes that suck up magic. There is magic in many things around the world. Magic in blood, tears, and fire. Takes blood from one of his open wounds that was left with him after the bats bit his flesh and spreads it on the map to scroll to a new area. It's no longer the simple, safe entryway, but a map of the confusing and vast tunnels of the pipework of the dwarves. He slowly spends hours poring over the map, charting a new way out. Once he has found it, he gets to his feet. A few unsteady steps, and then a pace. He moves forward quickly, believing soon I will be free of the dark.
So you follow this map.
Mm-hmm.
And because that has been 3 successes, you let fate slip through your fingers. You follow You follow this blueprint, and you see what you discover as you take a turn is that their plans changed.
Of course! Goddamn dwarves!
They, you know, they are builders by trade, and they may have added an addition, or perhaps they just changed their mind, but you look at this winding, perfectly square set of mining tunnels, and this one makes no sense. You see that the tracks actually move along the walls in ways that should defy physics. And it's just this winding, twisting tunnel. You look down it in your match, you almost find yourself hypnotized by this strange square spiral that lays out before you. You start to walk, and peril lurks in the dark.
God damn it.
You hear a rumbling. Dum 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 dum. You can't see anything, but from way down in the distance, you hear the thunking of metal on wood on metal. Something is riding on those tracks. Something long dead is riding a something on the tracks, and it's coming towards you.
Goodness gracious.
Sure got this perfect. I'm not doing this again. You see a ghost cart. A ghost cart. Skeletons, burning eyes, burning hair, burning dwarf beards are riding this cart and just barreling towards you, cackling with their skeleton laughs as they move towards you.
And so the scoundrel reaches at his side for the key. He grabs onto the key and runs forward. Of course, the dwarves would put carts in the tunnel. Of course, they would attempt to do this mad thing to move about. On land, humans know that the only way the gods intend for them to move is upon flesh. That is why man tamed beast and rides it to this day. To summon up the bones of the earth, the bones of demons, and refine them into these horrid machines, that is to create something twisted and awful. He sees the bones of the dwarves have grown tightly knit together in a horrible chimera creature reaching through the dark, screeching with a voice of metal, that high-pitched whine as it scrapes against other metal bones. He grabs the key and shoves it into the lock, that is just in front of them, pulling tight, fighting against the gears, using every last ounce of its strength to pull the switch. The cart rockets off the tracks. The screaming moans of dwarves, which have voices now that are high-pitched like metal whines, as it powers through the darkness, breaking many of the pipes below as once again the chaos is swallowed by night.
So, usually I would ask you to describe the thing, but I'm going to describe the last thing because I got a real clear idea.
Awesome.
And I assure you, one final peril lurks in the dark.
Of course.
You see it. It seems like an illusion at first, but you see it. The literal and metaphorical light at the end of the tunnel. It taunts you at first because it seems the further you walk, the further it gets. But you know that it's there, and you run, and you run, and there are tears in your eyes that are bleeding, you're crying into the wounds on your face, and it burns, and it stings. And everything suddenly feels so heavy because you're so close. You see it, and then you see it, and then you see her, your loved one. She holds Ruby in her hand, but she looks old, impossibly old. She appears to be immortal but not ageless, an aged wight standing before you. And she points at you and she says, you did this. You know, having run this far, you feel the ruby in your satchel. This cannot be her. Can't it? It can't be. So I ask you to light the match.
Oh, boy.
And describe.
This match better fucking light. Okay. So, he pulls for the locket at his side and opens it up, filling the air with the sweet smell of his love. That sweet smell lights something in his heart, in the dark, twisted heart of the scoundrel, a man who has done many things, a man who, by the accounts of many, would deserve nothing more but to suffer and die in the inky blackness of the deep. But even for a soul such as his, there is light. His heart beats with that light. It creeps through his body and into his mind and powers him forward as he walks through the illusion and towards the entrance of the Cave of Madness.
Now, sing the song of glory. Tell the song of glory that will remember you forever as you have triumphantly emerged from the cavern with the ruby.
Oh my God, what?
Describe your triumphant return to the surface. Glory and song will remember you forever.
The scoundrel blinks as he emerges into what to him is the brightest light imaginable. The light of the moon. It has been ages since he has seen it. It feels like weeks, maybe months. It could have only been a few hours. His body and mind are so fractured that he cannot tell the difference. He moves out of the cave, slowly breathing, moving forward and back into the town. There are some men with steely knives and cruel looks that watch him as he hurriedly moves back towards the town, towards the dwelling of his loved one. He knows that if he does not move quickly, there are darker souls than his that would steal the prize that he fought to win. And he enters the house. He sees his marriage bed, the woman sleeping now on it, struggling to live through her ragged breaths as sweat gathers on his brow. As he enters the door, the witch meets his eyes. She looks to him and asks, "Did you get it?" Slowly, he reaches towards his side and pulls out the ruby, now lit by the fire, appearing to glow with a light of its own, and nods as he hands it to her. She nods back, and the ruby disappears into the folds of her dress, and the witch is gone, and the woman who is his wife opens her eyes. They make eye contact. It is full of desperation, relief, and love. It is a love story that will be swallowed by time. Only they will ever know the sacrifices made to the dark. They will never tell the tale, because the scoundrel, no longer a scoundrel, wishes not to tempt any man down into the cruel fate that he almost suffered at the hands of the deep.
Whew. That scoundrel in the deep.
Man, what a great game.
Dang.
Jeff, thank you so much
thank
for playing
so much
with
for having me.
This is so much fun.
Oh, that was great. What a good game.
Yeah. Be sure to check out Party of One. I'm going to be on Party of One to play another one-on-one game with Jeff. And Jeff, where can people find your podcast and you?
They can find the show at soundcloud.com/partyofonepodcast, and they can find me on Twitter at partyofonepod. That's definitely the best place to keep up with the show and to get a hold of me. And tweet me junk, because I'm Twitter trash.
Aren't we all?
Well, heroes, that's it for One Shot this week, but don't worry, we'll be back next week with Exalted. That's right, One Shot is finally featuring a White Wolf game, and it's Exalted! Go figure that! A reminder to Los Angeles area heroes, I will be in your area doing a meet and greet at the Game House Cafe November 26th at 4 p.m. I'll be there to play games, hang out, maybe record a podcast. I don't know. I will also be joined by Jeff and John from System Mastery. So this is one nerdy meet and greet that you don't want to pass up, especially if you've got hot dog questions. Heroes, it's a frustrating and frightening world out there right now, but there are steps everyone can take to ensure that the future is better. One of the most effective things that you can do to make your voice heard is to call your local representatives. It can take just a few minutes out of your day and make a huge impact on politics moving forward. If you follow me on Twitter, you know that I take my lunch breaks and really any period during the day where I have a little bit of free time to call my reps about issues that matter to me. One issue that I'd urge everyone to call their representatives about as soon and as often as possible is President-elect Trump's financial conflicts of interest. All you have to do is take a moment to look up your state representative's phone numbers. Call them, voice your concern about the issue, and they'll take down your name and possibly your zip code. Most representative offices tally these calls and use them when making decisions on which positions they're going to take in the future. If you live in a state where your representative's views don't match your own, enough people calling can influence them. If you live in an area where your representative does align their views with yours, calling them to voice your support lets them know that the issue is important to their constituents. Calling your representatives is easier than writing a letter or sending an email, and it's more effective. If you get anxiety about phone calls like I do, you can use a script to make the call easier for you. In most circumstances, you just need to name the issue, and the person answering the representative's phone will know how to tally your views. If the issue is especially important or personal to you, telling a personal story to the representative over the phone can actually be very helpful. The personal stories you hear in political speeches are taken from folks who've reached out to the candidates to tell their story. Be polite, friendly, and persistent. To find contact information for your representative, simply follow the links in the show notes. One Shot is a proud partner in the Chicago Podcast Co-op. If you're an advertiser looking for an engaged Chicago audience, be sure to contact the co-op about advertising opportunities. And if you're a listener who wants to find a new show, try MBSing. Host Mary Beth Smith cuts the BS out of conversation by discussing a topic her guest unabashedly loves, thus discovering why people love what we do and how that passion affects us. As always, a big thanks to our supporters on Patreon. If you want to help us in a non-monetary way, the best thing you can do is tell a friend about the show. You can also leave us a rating or review on iTunes. Every 5-star review we get helps new people find the show. If you want to hear more from the show, be sure to follow us on Twitter at OneShotRPG. Look us up on Facebook at facebook.com/OneShotPod. Check out our Tumblr at OneShotPodcast.tumblr.com. Check out our Google Plus community. Or look for news on the site at OneShotPodcast.com. If you're looking to inquire about advertising rates, live appearances, and commissioning episodes, or you have a question or comment about something you heard on the show, contact us at gamemaster@oneshotpodcast.com. One Shot is a joint production between Peaches and Hot Sauce and Paracosm Press. Peaches and Hot Sauce is a Chicago-based comedy network with tons of great podcasts, videos, and live shows for you to check out at peachesandhotsauce.com. Finally, that music, which is right now swelling up over my voice, is Be Your Own Pet with Adventure, courtesy of Infinity Cat Records. See you next time, heroes.